I'm going to start off. Okay. Okay. Good. We on?
We're on.
We're on. First of all, the big thing I learned from everyone's finals is that no one reads modern Hebrew, and even modern Hebrew written by Ramim, which means that there's a real problem that you can't follow Israeli halacha or Israeli machshava. Forgetting the fact that you can't, read anything in general culture, but you can't even read the rabbinic writings at this point. There's a clear divergence that came out on many of your exams, and I've actually spoken to people that we've got to increase the Hebrew requirements in some way because you guys can't read Hebrew. Bad news. Even in many of you have spent time in Israel. In my time, Hebrew was 2 years. And the second year was lit and reading and stuff. Good. The second point is, while we're not giving the class an engaged yeshivish, it has come up, is that the engaged yeshivish method of doing philosophy is similar to Sadia's, to Kalam. It is that one can argue a point, and if you can make an argument, that's all you have to do. It doesn't have to be certain. It's not like philosophy, like the Rambam. It's not combining it with another corpus. But so long as you can dialectically create an argument, that's fine. It's more of a system of Sadia than of Rambam. And I'm not going to go into lots of examples of it, but just know that if I was giving another class on this point, I would be starting with that point. What I do plan on doing is now the Rav. It'll fill all of today, and if we have another meeting, we will finish the Rav and do Chabad and a few other side topics. Okay? You're now going to let me talk for a while before I take any questions. Enough of these Rav stories that have no grounding anywhere. First of all, there is currently a filmmaker out there planning on making a film about the Rav and an hour biography. And anybody he asked who knew the Rav in the 1950s, 60s, talked about the Rav as enigmatic and elusive, meaning people did not know about his life, there were no writings yet. The writings were all published at the end of his life or posthumously. So he was enigmatic. What he was, he gave these amazing shiurim at the Moriah Synagogue and in Boston. He was known for giving these incredible drashot, but he was enigmatic because people really didn't see the whole picture. He was also not in the public eye. You will not find him cited in the papers. Most of even when he is cited, he's cited in the Yiddish press. He was not out there on YU's PR logos in those days. He took very little part in public activities. Even when he wrote letters on public statements, he always included caveats, please keep this hidden, please don't show it, or it stayed buried to whoever it was given to. He rarely went out in public with a public statement. And I'm not going to try to say whether the right or the left is correct on the Rav. That's not the issue. The issue is he's very ambiguous and that he's enigmatic. So my goal is not to find some central point between the right and the left, which pleases nobody, but to deal with some of the enigmatic elements that make the Rav. And my goal here is also not to do philosophy of the Rav, but where the Rav fits into modern orthodoxy. I'm going to give a lot of the conclusions up front before we get to the writings. So let's start with the basic life story. His own father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, did break with the Volozhin tradition and did teach in the Mizrahi Yeshiva in Warsaw. The Rav started studying with his grandfather, Reb Chaim, at the age of 13. The Rav actually, in my time, told the story that his father wanted him to start with Ksuvis because of Shas Katan. The Rav said, no, let's start with Zvachim. And in the end, they agreed that he should start learning Bava Basra. But he learned, and he only learned with his grandfather between the ages of 13 and 17. Meaning then his grandfather died. His brother did not have that same relationship with Reb Chaim, because he was a younger brother, the other Rosh Hashiva. The Rav was undoubtedly an Eloi. His early Torah, shown in the letters to his father, are straight brisker Torah, straight Aguda world. Here is a young up-and-coming Eloi. He did study for gymnasium exams and attended the University of Berlin, where he took courses mainly in math, physics, and philosophy, more on the former than the latter. During that time, he became very friendly with Rav Chaim Heller, and what he was doing, trying to combine philology and Frumkeit. He met the Rebbe in those years, but the Rebbe just passed through, was not a matriculated student, and we're not going to get into that now. He never went there. He knew and ate meals with the Sri Deish, but that doesn't mean he had anything to do with the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary there. He ate meals with him, a limited number of places to eat meals in those days. Nechama Leibowitz says she never met the Rav, though they were there at the same time, because she didn't leave the library, which itself is a great story. But she had a chavrusa with Leo Strauss, which is a separate point. He also met in those days Yeshaya Leibowitz, who was at the university, and Eliezer Berkowitz, who was there. The Rav originally was going to write on Maimonides. And the advisor was actually the advisor that Alexander Altman took, but it was the relationship didn't work. Instead, he wrote on Herman Cohen, and he did a degree writing on Herman Cohen. But once again, it's a German doctorate, first degree, not a second degree. It's the equivalent of a Hebrew U master's, meaning it's a lit review and a summary. It's not what we'd call a doctorate in terms of doing something new.
Did they have higher levels?
That's because you had to do a second thing, a habituation geschrift, which was like at Hebrew U.
But did any of these figures do that?
Did any? Yeshaya Leibowitz did it 17 degrees, yes. He read 17 books or something before he left, or 18. I don't know the exact number. You had to write a second one in which the second one was original. So, Yishai Leibowitz certainly did. Altman, I think, did later when he moved to England to the Institute of Jewish Studies. Okay. He visits Israel. He then settles in Roxbury, lives in Roxbury, works building a Jewish community in Roxbury, and then eventually he and the rest of the community moved to Brookline. In the 1930s, in some ways he was rabbi there, Rav. He worked on the Kashrut. And in that he did not have great success. The meat industry really remained under Rav Savitsky, his rival from Newton. And the Kashrut organization, the Bada Rabbanim in Massachusetts, did not accept the Rav's opinions, and until very recently accepted stores to be opened on Shabbos, because the Rav was rather categorical. You couldn't sell a store to a guy, you couldn't do any harama, you couldn't keep it open on Shabbos. Vada Rabbanim in Massachusetts allowed all those things until recently. Kashrus did not wind up in his hands. So to the major synagogue in Brookline, was Keyleth Israel, a right-wing conservative congregation. He started attracting Talmidim in the 30s and in the 1930s till 40, incorporates a little yeshiva in 39 briefly. But among the students who are going to him during this time period includes the Rav Chait. It'll include Rav Scheinberger, the one with the tzitzis from Mathisdorf. It's Rav Shurin from Efrat. I went to a nice plane ride with him, in which he spent the entire plane ride telling me stories.
Another Shurin from Brooklyn also.
Yeah, yeah.
So who are the people on this?
Chaim Hinkle Scheinberg. Yeah, Chaim Hinkle Scheinberg, the Chaits, the Shurins.
The Armin Sion,
He then takes over giving shiur for his father at Reitz. And at that point, he's giving shiur, but it's not, nothing has really changed. Between 47 and 53, you even look in Rav Aaron's recent thing, it's a rather vague, slow, month-by-month process in which the Rav became head of the RCA, head of Reitz, head of lots of things, but there was not a one decisive before and after moment. It was a slow process as the months went on. And that was also the time period when the last moment of any rapprochement between JTS and YU and the RA and the RCA fell through. So the RCA really asserted itself, and really the Rav became the figurehead, legislator, legitimation of the RCA. He was their Rosh Yeshiva, he was their Gadol. He was their one who quoted philosophy and literature and told them to embrace the modern world. He told them to go out there and teach halacha. But even within the RCA, let's look at this a moment. It doesn't mean that everyone in the RCA was his student, even if they were students of Rav Gorelick and Rav Shatskis, meaning the world of Chaim Potok's novels. Once they became head of the RCA, it became the Rav Shlita for them. Or if they went to Nerius Royal or Chaim Berlin, if they took a suburban congregation, so too they started turning many of them to the Rav. Once again, hold on, it did not mean that they actually study with him. An example is Rav Kowalski from Queens, Shalom Kowalski. You can see that he started turning to the Rav in his new capacity as rabbi for a modern Orthodox congregation. Back to Shir. Between 40 to 61, he gave Shir in Yiddish, but he really was not overly giving of himself to YU. He had cancer in 58, 59. Of a cancer. When he came back in the 1960s, he increased his shiur time to now having marathon anywhere from 3 to 4 to 6 hours a day, if not more, of shiur. I mean, he increased his involvement with YU and with Talmidim. And in 1967, when he is a triple avelus, he changed from being a very sharp, a critical Magid Shir to a more grandfatherly Magid Shir. So where those who had him in the 1950s, he would scream at them, you know, a cow give milk in the 50s, or there used to be a club in the late 50s called the Ferret Club, of people that the Rav called a ferret, a horse. That disappeared after 67. He mellowed out. But at the same time, not only did he mellow out personality-wise, he downloaded more Torah when he talked. I actually like, there are notes you should find from the Shiurim from 1939-40 from Boston, and you could really see the Rav engaged and working through what he wanted to say. for example, replacing wherever the Rambam mentions philosophy, replacing it with Talmud Torah, and working that through for the Menachos Sugyas of Tzitzis Tefillin, a mezuzah also, showing where the Rambam sees it as pointing to philosophy, the Rav made it point to Talmud Torah, and you see it worked through. The 50s, you still see him working on his shirim. From the 68 to 82, when you read the Masorah notes, you'll see at that point, you mention a topic and he just downloads his worldview. Even though he's still working things out in Shir and will say things differently, he already had much of it in place and would then be very much more associative and give you whole packages at once.
Can we give a practical example of that?
No. There would be a practical example would be he knew already the entire where everything was going, so you could start off and if there would be only a little, okay, we did Sota, there's a little bit of Sota, Tosus brings in a question about Shabbos. The Rav will then talk about Malacha Geruah, what is Malacha, and this, what is Lamed Tes, what is Lav, what is Tolda, not necessarily needed for that Tosfos, but he told you all his golden punchlines. They were similar punchlines, because there was a clear point that the Rav, as we're going to see, is incredibly creative, and if someone got up there and said, but Rebbe, you said this in 1954, he would come in the next day and say just the opposite, and give you a different mahalech. He liked being continuously creative. Next. So too, in terms of his politics, was a change. While his father taught in Mizrahi, and he wasn't a good inik when he tried out for the chief rabbinate of Israel, chief rabbi Tel Aviv against Rav Amiel. In the late 50s, he became strongly Mizrahi, in a very halachic sense. He also had a strong anti the Das Torah of not moving from Europe and everything will be fine in Europe and opposing the State of Israel. And in post-1967, there was a lot more statements of trust the generals, not the rabbis in terms of the security. And a lot of those statements were elicited by the Israeli press and others who kept calling him for statements. There'll be some papers coming out from the Van Leer Soloveitcha conference, explaining somehow a lot of these statements really did come to be generated by the press, and it really did become what Soloveitcha was known for in Israel. Okay, let's now talk about problems about why there are so many Ravs, why there's a right and a left, why there is so much different opinion. Unlike Rav Kook, who clearly had a universal reality, a universal vision, but a rather Haredi reality. So there was only two Rav Kooks. And there was only a universal liberal vision, but a rather restrained political one on the ground. The Rav generated hundreds of different perspectives. I don't think it's left and right, and I don't think they all line up. First of all, the Rav is someone raised in Brisk to Warsaw to Berlin to Boston of the 1930s is very different than any of our worlds. There was a clear, his whole world, before he even came to YU, he had lived in three different countries that are just not America. Two, he gave different statements to different students. Or he would talk to his students, what do you think? Or how would you figure things out? So there are clearly different statements out there. While there are similar trends, there are multiple statements. Three, he fielded questions on anything. He played that role. If you ask Rebbe, I just learned in graduate school this about psychology, he would answer you back, that's good, but the halachic approach to psychology is this. If someone else says, Rebbe, I just read the Ketzos, and he would answer, the Ketzos is nice, but my mahalach is this. No matter what you asked him, he would field the question from any direction. So everybody walked out thinking he was on the same page as they were. Hold on. Next, the Rav also used the language of the halacha says. Now the question becomes, which halacha? Some of the Talmidim says, oh, the halacha says, therefore, when I now go and bring in Rav Unterman's and Rav Roth and Rav Uziel's tshuvas in my congregation, that's what the Rav is talking about. Someone else said, no, the halacha says means we follow the Mishnah Brura. A third person says, no, the halacha says means the Rambam through a brisker approach. The Rav only spoke the halacha says, and all his Talmidim got up there and said, the halacha says. He never corrected and never filled that in. Five, he was very tolerant of different opinions. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in his article about the Rav, says, unlike Rav Kook, who was very universal in his opinions, but very intolerant on the ground, the Rav was incredibly tolerant as a person, and even unless you were saying something that was really going the opposite of what he wanted, he would not correct you. Examples. And these are all going to be different types of examples. One, he could get up there and give shiur and say from the Rambam, everyone must use only dry wine because only dry wine without sugar is the only thing roilim is beach. So I know a Boston balabas who now switched over to only drinking dry wine and then brought it up with the Rav a few months later. And the Rav, when he saw the Rav drinking sweet wine, and then the Rav says, yes, I know, that's what I thought what I was doing in Shir. That was not paskening halacha. That's one. Two, the Rav held, unlike the Shlah that says you only do nefila during Tachanun with a Sefer Torah, the Rav held you always did nefila. In the Rav's own time, it was yuhara for anyone who wasn't in the Rav's Shir to do nefila without a Sefer Torah in the room. It wasn't a general psak. At YU, you followed Minhag Ashkenaz. Next, and more most importantly, is even if the Rav would give shir, I mean, for example, on Tisha B'Av, this is the way we should do the keynote, the Shlich Tzibur sometimes could completely ignore the Rav, and the Rav didn't intercede. Or the Rav would give shir, we have to break up the Psukim of Kriyas HaTorah the following way, and whoever's laning with the Gabbai would not follow the Rav's approach, and the Rav would be sitting right there, having just given shir 15 minutes earlier, and will not protest. Okay, that's a real big part of who the Rav was. He was giving his worldview, but he wasn't putting it into place. Yes?
Then he was afraid of creating some sort of disharmony?
I don't think we should be reading motivations into it. I think that's just how he was. He was very tolerant of these sort of things. Yes?
Some people want to distinguish the Rav of Boston from the Rav of New York, but the Rav of Boston is more of a leader, a paisek, while in New York he's more of a malame. He's more... So the Rav didn't want New York to accept his...
Even in Boston, I was there many a times in which, the Shlich Tzibur would do the exact opposite of what the Rav just gave share on. And the Rav would not get involved. Yes?
What was his role in onset?
What? Okay, let's hold on. Let's go and get to that. Is... Okay, next, everyone knows his very famous opinion, which he was adamant about, that you can't daven in a congregation with mixed seating. But since we also know the statistics that 30% of YU Mismachim and 70% of Hebrew Theological College Mismachim took congregations with mixed seating, therefore at least a third of his followers of the RCA had mixed seating congregations. He was not getting up there and saying, don't come to me as a Talmud unless you give up your congregation. So clearly he was regularly addressing a body of individuals, of whom a third of which had mixed seating congregations, yet he was adamant in no uncertain terms with the strongest rhetoric that it's better not to go to shul than to attend these things. That's the sort of thing that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein points out, is that the Rav's rhetoric can be incredibly one way, but at the same time, he's not getting up there and demanding it from his Talmidim. Yes?
The story is told that when he was in Berlin, he was asked a similar question about davening in a only shul and in Kippur, Shem and Kippur, his reform shul, and he purported to have said it's permitted to go into that synagogue.
Right, and therefore?
And a generation later, then in America, he's saying...
Okay, that's part of the ambiguity, the incredible ambiguities. You can cite lots of these sort of cases. Next, his first writing to be published was Lonely Man of Faith. Halachic Man was written in a Hebrew that you guys can't read Hebrew. RCA rabbis could not read, or YU graduates really couldn't. Very few could read the Lonely Man of Faith in Hebrew. I remember one of the RCA presidents once told me, it was great. I remember when he gave the shiur of Lonely Man of Halachic Man in Yiddish, and that's what he remembers it from. But he hasn't ever looked at the Hebrew version. The first English writing of the Rav was Lonely Man of Faith, and then followed by Conspectus, those articles from Hamavaser. Meaning that everybody knew him only orally, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute.
Is there a Masorah that went around, like a cliff notes to the Rav?
The Masorah of the Rav came in a photocopy box. It was, you know, whatever that comes out to. How many reams of paper are in a photocopy? No, about the whole box. What? So whatever, it's 5,000. There's a box of about 5,000 pages of the Masorah that sold for so many dollars. And you bought a copy. It had a full set, it had a very large set of notes. I remember I did not buy the set. I, at that point, used to borrow them from others, including now the, if you want to admit it, but the Rosh, now the Rabbi Yonason Sachs. I used to go to his room and borrow his set and read through them. But there's basically a 5,000 page Masorah that everybody bought, that, you know, that, for the whole box. So all the people who really memorized the Rav Torahs had a full set of that. There was also a separate that wasn't part of that official set, the Boston Shiurim, from the 40s and from his Saturday Night Shiurim and from the Shiurim, there's a poli-sci professor, Steve Oren, who also edited a very funky set that caught the Rav on the Vietnam War and all sorts of other things. There wasn't happening, but the official New York set was, I think, at least 5,000 pages. And a lot, and you really, we all circulated them and read them and reread them, because you would certainly, whatever Masechet you're learning and share that year, you would read through a version or two.
It's like what Chapman does now with his own notes from then.
Yeah, you would read through a version, and you would certainly read through things like Philosophy of Prayer, which now came out as a book, but originally was 57, and then before, like 50 or 47 or whatever it was. You read through those notes, long beforehand. But since those notes were all taken by people who, like unedited student notes, they all reflect They all reflect all sorts of gaps, all sorts of funny marks. You know, I remember the Philosophy of Prayer version. I mean, I'm not going to say which pulpit rabbi took the notes, but it says, and the Rav mentions that there's a charismatic message, and it's spelled in the notes with a C, not with a K, and a little marginal note. What does this mean? there's lots of that sort of stuff in the original sense. Which also says a lot about what people were getting from them.
Are they still around?
Yeah. You can ask him personally what he's using. I mean, I only have some of them. I paid for the ones that I wanted for the Masechtos that I was most interested in the topic, so I have whatever, half a shelf or whatever shelf downstairs in the basement of these notes. But the point is they don't serve a function anymore because a lot of them have come out through other people. But at the time, you know, anything I knew that I was going to be using and teaching, I did. I did not, you know, you bought the ones that were most relevant.
But it's not uncommon to have, you know, two sets of notes saying two opposite things
yeah.
in two different years.
That's right. That's correct.
So there's no attempt that when they would publish any shiurim, they would seek all the types of notes to...
I think that becomes a question of the editors, and we can talk. I mean, that's a separate thing. Each editor of the Rav on a given Masechet has a different approach, and it's not all out on the table of all the different approaches that are out there of the editors. But as it is, it does not seem that anybody is including everything, because some people want to make the Rav completely clean and glossed, as if everything was right there. Some people, on the other hand, want to, you know, do the latest version. Not our topic. Okay, other reasons. Another reason for ambiguities is the way he gave shiur. Because, for example, one summer he was doing Yeridaya, and we just did Mumar L'Teavon and Mumar L'Hachis about not being kasher l'shechita. And then after we finish doing it in that form, the Rav then goes in and says he knows people who used to go to Yom Kippur balls that later became members of his Chevra Shas. So one doesn't know about in America. It doesn't really work like this. What message do you then take from that? The Rav didn't say anything like Rav David Zvi Hoffman saying, yes, we're now going to give people who are not Mechal Shabbos and Aliyah. He's not like the Rabbanut in Israel who would put it on the table for some greater image of Klal Yisrael that, you know, Yisrael Afa Pishachati was part of Yisrael. He just tells you a story about people who went to Yom Kippur balls who are now part of the Chevra Shas and go to shul regularly.
Is he therefore applying that?
We don't. Then you can't apply. He's not doing any analysis. He's telling the story, so everyone took from that something different. That same different summer, we talked. I mean, there are a lot of these stories you can give that he would just throw out a story, and then what's the upshot? What does that mean? If you just did the halacha and here's a story. What are you taking? Obviously, what you're taking back to your congregation is a greater sense of tolerance, but how that plays itself out, there's no official statement. Next, the Rav also creates ambiguities because he loved making quips. For example, Golda Meir visited YU. Someone asked the Rav, how can Golda Meir be run the Israeli government? Doesn't it need to be a man? A question that Rav Shaul Yisraeli, as a Mamachti Dati position, clearly answered, saying, no, there's no Srarer anymore. Once again, since you guys couldn't even read Rav Shaul Yisraeli's Svarim. The Rav just said, you have a problem with Golda Meir? You didn't have a problem with Ben-Gurion? Now, what message do you walk away with? It creates an ambiguity. Okay, next thing that people have mentioned already, the Rav put on two personas, Boston versus New York. And clearly the Boston persona, I know I'm going to get into trouble for this on some level, certainly about Tefillah, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein will tell the stories, the Rav was not overly machfid on Tefillah B'Tzibur or anything having to do with it. The Rav was also incredibly lenient in terms of kashrut in Boston, whether Kraft cheese or gelatin or anything else like that. And obviously he did have a kibana and onset in Cape Cod where there was mixed swimming. His persona in Boston was clearly a very different persona than the persona in New York. In New York, he played things much straighter, much more being the Magid Sheer. He was much more a relaxed figure in Boston. So that created two separate personas. Once again, it creates the problem. I mean, Bostonians will tell you the stories. Got lots of them when I taught at Maimonides. That, you know, clearly the OU did not give Hashgacha the gelatin, does not follow the Achiezer. But in the Rav personally in Boston seems to, and a lot of the Balabatim, have these stories that he used to go out. He used to, for one thing, visit them for their barbecues and in their backyards and go out for ice cream with them. And, you know, the Rav being adamant that he wanted his whipped cream. And yes, he knows what the halacha is.
What's the issue?
The ready whip in... They used to have some form of a gelatin in the... And
what,
it doesn't...
What was his position on black kosher? Black kosher, or was it not...
I don't think it was much of... I mean, that's a whole separate thing, what even that word means.
Right.
So I'm going to leave that out of it. Clearly the Rav had a lot of problems with Western meat and the whole training it in process. He clearly did not like the hashkachas of a lot of the New England meat. And I don't want him to get into the details of it. And a lot of, I think he did have his meat imported from New York.
But also, since the early stuff in kosher in Boston, he got the whole argument, so it didn't just like kind of shot away.
That's right. So let me just go on more things. Next, he also took on a persona which he even wrote, you know, his plane tickets and his train tickets always said Joe Solo. He always had this persona of being an isolated individual. And he went out of his way to be an isolated individual. Like whenever you see him appear in public or when he visits the Rebbe, you go look at when he visited the Rebbe, he put on a light blue sports jacket and a bar mitzvah kippah. Meaning he did not want to be pegged, pigeonholed, judged by externals. So that also creates ambiguities. He did not take on the public role much of the time. Let's give you some more examples of confusion. He was the official head of World Mizrahi Movement, so he appears on the podium with Rav Shragai. And if you remember Rav Shragai's positions from Poel HaMizrahi, he would let people, and there's a certain pulpit rabbi who would introduce them. The Rav and Rav Shragai have the same opinions on Judaism. What was the poor pulpit rabbi to think if you brought home Rav Shragai's writings from Kibbutz Hadati, and you brought home the Rav, and you have a RCA president introducing them as saying the same thing? What was a poor person to think? So this wasn't even because of the Rav. The Rav did not, and the Rav never got up and protested nor did Irv Chagai to say that they were held differing opinions. Yes.
How much, when we talk about quote-unquote leniencies in the Rav, how much of that is just a different set of priorities? Because I get the sense, like, it's not that he didn't care about kashrus or mix something. It's just like his kashrus was just totally different than, you know, the OU standard centrist definitions.
I never used the word machmir or mekel. He had a brisker piety of what he was concerned with.
And did he fast on minor fasts?
I don't know.
Because that's like an example of something.
The answer is certainly in my time he did.
Yeah. And glasses on Shabbos.
I don't. And worry about the Balamor. I mean the sitzes and the Balamor and all those.
Yeah.
That okay. The answer is you can get contradictory statements on some of those, and I never collected all the contradictory statements. But in my time on minor fast days, clearly everyone fasted. But he said there's no mitzvah to be mariach and fanesim. In terms of calculating when the day ended.
Uh-huh.
Next is he forever would, you know, continuing that one, he would say they don't understand me, they think I'm an apikores. You know, he wasn't putting his own philosophy, his own synthesis of Torah and philosophy on his students. He never really gave imprimatur to his students, or on the other hand, he never took anything away. So, he himself was claiming, you know, that no one understands his whole worldview. Before I go on, let me give you 10 qualities of the Rav, with the converse 10 things the Rav is not. First of all, the Rav was clearly intellectual and wanted to show a responsible intellectual vision of Judaism. Repeats that over and over again. But what the Rav was not was trying to do apologetics for any modern philosophy or modern issue. The Rav wanted to show intellectual credibility. He wanted to give a great abstract understanding to show, you know, great intellectual structure, but he wasn't answering up Freud, Darwin, Marx, or anyone else. That wasn't his agenda. 2, he was a Lamdan abstraction, gave formulations of things. But what he wasn't was a posek, and Rabbi Blau has a very nice share explaining that. The Rav did not claim to be a posek. He wanted to be a lamdan and give share. 3, he was an authority figure and gave legitimation for the RCA. But the converse is no, he wasn't doing the public policy, nor was he the one appearing in public. Do not have this heroic image of therefore the, you know, the Rav then appearing the next day in the New York Times or the Jewish Week. The RCA could have just as likely sent Rabbi Rachman to then give over the Rav's opinion to the New York Times or the Jewish Week rather than he doing it. 4, the Rav had a philosophy of how all modern man is lonely, in solitude, isolated, seeking meaning. The converse is he wasn't a happy-go-lucky, this-worldly, let's all work together and build things and be gregarious, like almost all of his students left and right. I mean, the Rav really was, whenever he talked, it was about this great self-reflective man in isolation. And almost every one of the students left and right, it speaks in a very gregarious, collective sort of tone.
Let me point out, you write a lot about that.
Yes.
That's similar to this?
Similar to this. 5, his major point was education, education, day school, and the school has got to be intellectual. The converse is that he wasn't in favor of emotional or volitional approaches in schools. And once again, most of our day schools have much emotional, volitional, chevra elements that he just wasn't into. Meaning you would only, he really had a policy of you would be praised for intellectual achievements, not for the basketball team or youth group or anything else. Or having taught in Maimonides, there was once a visiting Israeli teacher who opened their mouth saying, we've got to make it fun and emotional and sing along and get kids to really be into it and makarev them. And Rabbi Twersky, who was running the faculty meeting, shot that person down so quickly, saying, no, it's, as we've learned from the Rav, it's got to be intellectual, abstract, inspiring people to the highest ideals. None of the emotionalism. Wait, hold on. The Rav Shear is usually a very simple dichotomy in Chumash between Rashi Ramban, or between Tosfos Rambam, or it could be Rambam Ravid or Rambam Ramban. Meaning it was always set up as a, here are two different mahalchim. Finished.
Did he try to reconcile them?
No. In fact, he actually showed you they're worlds apart. There are two different approaches. Either one holds like Tosos or one holds like the Rambam.
Well,
he was not, that's not, already you're not going where he's going. He would be masbir how they are completely different. But what he wasn't, and which his Talmidim are, was then connecting it to the incredible Bekiyas of Rishonim and Achronim that all Talmidim then have. Because, you know, if he set it up as a Machlokas Rambam Tosfos or Rambam Ravid, what about the Ritva and the Shita Lona Dalami and all the other Shita Sabbeinu Peretz and all the other stuff we schlep around and our Ketzos and Tzivos? You didn't bring that to Shear, it didn't play a role, and that really does create an ambiguity. The Rav would say there are two Mahalchim. Sometimes he would further divide and say it's Tosfos versus Rambam, and then he would then divide the Rambam into two further approaches, but it wasn't the Bekiyas that we're all bringing, yes.
Just like a Shear, for example, Kli Kofs the Mechayev B'Tzitzis. So the Rav comes to the Rav comes to a conclusion that's essentially very similar to something in the Shagas Aryeh. So either A, he read the Shagas Aryeh.
He was incredible Yediyas. He had incredible Yediyas and knew the Shagas Aryeh. But the point the.
But he didn't put it in there. He might have been reminded of it.
The point is the goal of the Shear was a very clean giving you a dichotomy.
And if it says on the bottom, Hishavu, you know, Shagasari, Lama Zion.
Oh, that wasn't him. That was the editor. So also that depends on who you had for your Chazara Shear. Some people who had Chazara Shear said you don't look things up. Some said you did. So I hear that those people who had Rav Reichman for Chazara Shear, it was all about Svara. While my time I had Rav Khan for Chazara Shear, and he would give us long lists of Mara Makomos and say, how can you not know all these Mara Makomos, and how can you not be a Day of Sefer? Unfortunately, it had an effect on me, and to this day, I didn't look everything up. But I mean, once again, that also creates different. Whoever gave the Chazara Shear about how it's being presented. Do you have to do the Shargas Aryeh? Do you not? Whoever gave the Chazara Shear determined it for you.
But he himself did the Shargas Aryeh.
He himself did. But the point is, all you heard was the simple machlokas. Unless he had a reason to bring something else in.
Why is he sketching archetypes?
That was his very derech and limud. That was the very derech, and we're going to come back to that either today or maybe next time at this rate. Where am I up to? Okay, next. He was very rational and anti all forms of superstition. He openly made fun of Musar, Hasidus, Eastern Europe, and there are many people of Hasidic Yechus who've now gone back and claimed, you know, various forms of being reopening the Tish or whatever, who are still upset that the Rav would openly, you know, criticize Hasidus in front of them, or Musar, or Rebbe Shazachin. So what he wasn't was he did not have nostalgia for the old country except as expressed through Peretz or Grada and Yiddish literature. The fact that we did whatever this custom in the old country, you know, whatever Hasidic thing, he did not go, he did not defend. Eight, he was interested in conceptualization, epistemology, construction, building the ideal world. And what he wasn't interested in is ethics, values, and motivation. So all the debates left and right are about ethics, values, and motivation. And the Rav was about abstraction and construction of theory. And that's a real major abyss, and you'll go back and see halachic man is conceptualizing the universe. Most of the Talmidim are arguing about values, left and right, open and closed. He was about conceptualization. Nine, he was incredibly creative. An incredible machadesh. And therefore, what he wasn't was just wanting you to memorize the notes. He brought with a certain freshness that you really had to re-derive at each time. Finally, a quality that he talks about that very few of the Talmidim pick up on is the quality of Ha'olam, of being secret, of not having a name, a drasha that he gave often. I think it actually is in the letters, but it can't come all the time. The Anshei HaMesorah are anonymous. It's not about their life details and their biographies. It's not about their individuality as people, but it's about being part of the Anshei HaMesorah who keep the halacha going. So what it's not about is a biography of the Rav and personalities and our human narrative sense. The Rav was really not into the narrative sense of human life. It is in fact about the anonymity and our frailness, and we transcend our frailness by becoming part of the Mesorah. And what we see now is a great deal of talking about human life and human needs and you know, Bershi Yeshiva having clear personalities. Yes?
Whereas I've been told that in a graduate course, the Rambam by Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, when he left his Halakha Rambam, he'll expect that the student is seeing, you know, all any relevant text to that. Is that something that's taken from his father? Or
no. His father was incredibly anti-Girsa. In fact, his father used to go out of his way of justifying a lot of the worst Girsos. Dafka to show that that's not our Mahalech, how we're not JTS, how we're not Hildesheimer Seminary.
Is that a reaction to the growth of those other institutions, or the success of it?
The success of what? Looking for Girsas?
Or the success of the Berlin...
I think it also has to do with the fact that we now have Svarim, that now have incorporated them all, and we can't... It's hard to turn a blind eye. But the Rav was not mocked at all on Girsa. Yes, the Rav was not interested in personalities and shuvas and the social situations they responded to. The halacha was an abstract enterprise. And he repeated that often. So once again, he'll use the phrase, the halacha is, but most rabbis, when they actually have to deal with the real world, had to choose Rav Unterman or Rav Moshe Feinstein. Are you choosing the Ramah? Or are you choosing... the Maharam Mince Me Padua. You had to choose real tshuvas, and the Rav was really about abstraction, not tshuvas. So once again, that leads to an ambiguity. Okay. Now, on page 9091 from the letters, I'm using this just out of convenience. I could have taken this from other places. There is a speech here that this is dealing with the medical school. Now, it's just a side point. I want to point out that the Rav was asked about the medical school. He was asked by the Yiddish press. This appeared in the Yiddish press. Therefore, all of his Modernisha students and the worlds that they lived in, the young Israel of suburbia, they had very little concern for the Yiddish press. He was asked about the medical, why you in the medical school. So he first starts off and he says he wasn't consulted about the decision. That's an important part of understanding why you. He wasn't consulted on these things. President Belkin with his...
He wasn't the president.
He wasn't the president, but nor was he Rabbi Joseph Lookstein, Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, Rabbi Leo Stitzkin, or any of the other of the inner circle that got to help decide these questions. He wasn't consulted. He already starts off the letter saying a great line. Our entire existence has always been the Eved. The whole human existence is not lechatchila. So we're always living in a state of the Eved, which is a great way to create ambiguity of therefore what is your true value. But the speech on page 9091, he repeated over and over again. Today's Orthodox community, like the entire Jewish community, emphasizes and appreciates the respect of their opponents to a vastly greater degree than any love the opponents may profess for them. The ability of the Orthodox community to influence others is commensurate with the respect they deserve, meaning the goal was to create a respectful Orthodoxy. Okay, in contrast, love, which is based on goodwill or sympathy, the Orthodox community can win the respect of others by focusing on and excelling in three areas. One, living their personal lives on a higher ethical religious level. Two, defending their principles and ideals in a forthright and uncompromising manner. Three, demonstrating to the world that the Torah Jew need not cower in a corner and gaze with sadness and resignation as life in the world passes him by. The Orthodox Jew must demonstrate that he navigates with pride the flow and currents of the modern world and participate in a life that is racing with ever more rapidly toward new horizons and great accomplishments in the domain of science and technology. We must demonstrate that in all cultural, social, and scientific situations, a Jew can study Torah and live as a faithful Torah Jew. Okay? So how far did he want to go? What did he mean? He repeated this so often, regularly, that Orthodoxy has to demonstrate in all cultural, social, and scientific situations its relevance. Now, that itself was a big part of his message. That's the way many understood halachic man, that halacha has to be rational, scientific, this worldly, embrace all cultural, scientific, and social situations. So all the debates left and right are about what does that mean. But he gave an imperative that that Orthodoxy should not hide in a corner and gaze with sadness and resignation. Yes?
Just going back to the seeing abstractions where there are other two flesh and blood people, is there like any kind of Neoplatonist read that we could spin in where there's some sort of abstract Sophia and abstract ideas going out there?
Okay, Michael Morgan, a professor of philosophy out in the Midwest somewhere, has an article, Seeing the Rav as a Platonist.
Okay. Can we do the post-rational thing like we did with the Rambam? Like, say, like, really the Rav thought in the end the halachic man meditates on the...
No.
He didn't mean
that. He didn't mean that at all.
So we have to wait 20 years before he said that.
Okay. Next element about... So the first thing is that Orthodoxy is to go out and embrace the world. Every student of the Rav took that. You know, everyone from left to right, anybody who is, says Orthodoxy has to embrace the world. Yes?
You said earlier that the Rav... My question is, did he ever speak out against any students?
Did he ever say...
For example, whereas at the other rabbinical seminaries, the head of the seminary spoke out against...
No.
The Rav didn't...
What he would do is in Boston, not in New York, because in New York... He would sooner make fun of you. There's one student who's now a Rosh Hashiva that once said a Svara and Shir wanting to say that Sukkah is a Gavra, and he screamed at him, no matter what, I know the difference between Chepza and Gavra, and Sukkah is definitely a Chepza. I mean, he would make a fool out of you in the New York, because you already knew the parameters. New York was already a certain... You know, if you're sitting there and you have a lot of people who came regularly, you really didn't know the parameters. However, in Boston, he would go after people. Some of the Balabatim, like I remember him saying to some of the Balabatim, I like you very much, except when you start talking like you're a conservative rabbi. He would shoot down Balabatim more. Okay. However, we're going to get to, he did criticize people in the 1970s in some very public incidents. Yes?
When you say all the students of the Rav say that in the Rav they have to embrace the world, what do you mean by embrace the world?
I have no idea. Whatever you want to take that paragraph to mean. That's exactly the point. That's the ambiguity. And that's why I don't think it's about finding a center between left and right. I think he said to embrace the world, and each student... interpreted it in their own way. That's why I don't think there is a true meaning of what that is. Yes?
Will you gauge the right, left, and center of the Rav on women's issues?
No, because that really was so not on his agenda, not on his radar. It wasn't, it really wasn't his, really where he put his mind into. I would not make that the litmus test.
All
right. Yeah, I'd pick a 1950s issue.
No, but let's say a contemporary issue where, let's say, women's aliyah.
It was not on. It was not on.
But to try to read into that, it's incorrect.
I would not play that game because that wasn't his issue.
No.
That doesn't mean he would be in favor of it. But the point is, it'll just that's not the litmus test. It's take one of the real issues. Like something he really hated was liturgical innovations. Making up new prayers like the 1950s. Okay? So on one hand, the RCA Sidur under Di Salo Poole clearly had liturgical innovations and was much more of a modern liberal prayer book. But the Rav, as head of the RCA, did not come out and condemn it. He just in the end said, you know, when people would ask him, what should you do? He would say, I don't want any of these new things, when asked. You know, should we have a service for Yom HaShoah? The answer is absolutely not. We're not creating... Right? That's right. Okay, that's a perfect example. We should give an intellectual shiur. If you want to open up with one hymn of thanksgiving, but we give an intellectual shiur, he left it to his Talmidim to figure it out, but we don't do the liturgical innovations. And that was the official position, but at the same time, some of his students did them anyway. That was a real example of his real position, his tolerance, even when... not listened to, and at the same time was an issue of those times, of that time. Okay. Another thing that comes up again and again in his writings is being pro-America, since you bring up the 300th anniversary of America, but also the Rav used to give a shiur on Thanksgiving. And you can download those on the web. I usually give those out to the modern survey class. The Rav gave a shiur almost every Thanksgiving, meaning whatever the Gemara shiur is, he would then, you know, give the last half hour or something, talking about America. All of them, I mean, I'm quoting here just from the version from the letters. I mean, I could quote from the one of the web versions. We have to thank America, that America is a great country based on biblical philosophy. And depending on the year you caught him, he could even talk about its great democracy and biblical dignity and the great Judeo-Christian ethic of the country. Two, he points out here the miracle of how American Jewry is surviving here and prospering. Three, the religious freedom for Orthodox Jews. And then, not in this letter, but in many of the shiurim, he will then castigate America for being materialistic, for idealizing people who are in show business or sports rather than intellectuals, how America is gregarious and all happy-minded rather than truly being understanding the paradoxes of human existence and truly understanding our aloneness before God and the need to be redeemed.
Isn't that a problem everywhere you go?
But know that there was a standard shiur that you can find lots of versions of. So you're asking, what did he do for American Orthodoxy? Is that he was a Rosh Hashiva that would come out and say, wow, here's America. Dealing with some other of these. Here, I'm sure a lot of you read how, the debate where Rabbi Jung wanted to talk about religion and ethics, and the Rav wanted to talk about epistemology. I mean, the Rav really reveals himself at every point as being interested in epistemology. But I want to, as a shorthand, another speech that was a part of many of the Rav's books, whether Ala Tshuva or on Tefillah, is the top of page 298, where he's answering a question dealing with Pidyon HaBen. He's answering a priest about Pidyon HaBen. And the line he gives at the part of 298 is a big part of who the Rav was. In light of this majesty di and unqualified belonging experience, we understand the Judaic philosophy of sacrifice. The principle of sacrifice is a central motif in Judaism. The whole Judaic cult ritual and ethos revolves around this theme. To live in accord with God's word is identical with living a sacrificial life. To act morally is synonymous with sacrificial action. What did man bring as an offering? What did he sacrifice? Man must offer everything he possessed. Nothing is to be spared. A sacrificial action consists in restoring that which man herefore considered his own rightful owner and returning it to the master. And then later he talks about a kid at Yitzchak and quotes Kierkegaard, how we're always engaged in this Kierkegaardian sacrifice. That's an important part of the Rav's philosophy. We are always engaged in sacrifice. Natural man is for the Rav is seen as not good. So unlike Rav Kook's natural ethics, or we can speak from a regesh of the heart, for the Rav, natural man is always unredeemed, unsacrificial, unconnected to God. Man must always make a redemptive sacrificial act by accepting religion, by accepting ethics. A natural ethic is no good for the Rav. You must make a sacrificial act and accept a religious ethic. Prayer. It's not enough to have an outpouring of a natural heart. You have to have a sacrificial act and understand one's relationship and offer everything up before the higher deity. Every point, it's always unnatural man is never correct. Yes, we have human relationships and natural marriage, but no, it has to be sanctified and have a sacrificial act of kedushin, raising it from the natural element.
Sanctification from without.
So, okay, it was always a sanctification from without. It is always a coming to be. It is always our unredeemed state. We lead an unredeemed, materialistic, hedonistic life, if not for the redemption of our submission to the Torah world. And in that importance, because that's a big part of who the Rav was, and it was almost never told by his Talmidim. Some of his Talmidim preserve it, but most don't, both left and right. Most of his Talmidim left and right are happy campers who lead natural existences. But this incredible part, his tolerance, his RCA rabbis who wrote halachic guides to death and marriage are all about halacha is good for you in a this worldly way. And most of modern orthodoxy was about this worldly value of mitzvot. And the Rav was about this redemptive sacrificial element. So too much of centrism is about our natural halachic sense and about how we're all, naturally going to lead a life of being a Ben Torah. And here, once again, they're not going to say no. We have to take a redemptive sacrificial moment. Okay, it was a big part of the Rav's philosophy, plays a role in almost all of his essays, and does not play a role in the Talmidim the same way. Some of them still have it. Okay, we're not going to start name-dropping who still has it and who doesn't, but some still have it. But much of the world of the Talmidim does not. Yes.
I was like once in a shul in Israel, and I was very surprised because the rabbi got up and gave a drasha to his like half Anglo, half Israeli people on Beit Shemesh, and it was all about the motif of sacrifice in the Rav and how religion makes us uncomfortable, davka.
Right.
And like then he's like, we should really make minyan 10 minutes earlier. That was what he extrapolated from. Mm-hmm. So where does that come from? Is that like a Davtin Hadashim reading?
For one thing, the Rav is not a Musarnik. It's not Schar Halicha. It's about that being a confronted individual, a redemptive moment in your life, how suffering realizes that we're all transitory and there's a higher meaning. It's not about any of the daily elements. I can't, without going into personalities, I can't go into the details. Because the upshot is not that you should come 10 minutes early. The upshot is realizing
that you should suffer through it and it should be forced to the
fight. Yeah, yes.
Did the Rav write differently to Jews and non-Jews?
No.
He's quoting Gemara's...
Okay, so the difference is he writes differently. The editing is different in both. Meaning, Lonely Man of Faith, the halacha is only in the footnotes, not in the text itself.
I'm saying more of these letters that we see. When he's writing to the priest.
Okay, when he's writing to the priest, he does not do the halacha is not part of the text itself, only the biblical verses. For non-Jews, he only did biblical verses, our common biblical heritage, but for the Jewish audience would be in the footnotes. Okay. And that essay once again ends off one not only about sacrifice, about how everything we do in life needs to have infinite grace. Meaning everything needs that God's redemptive element. On 335, in the book, this is interesting because it's a letter to Chaim Grada about Chaim Grada's presentation of the Chazon Ish. Presents the Chazon Ish as having great passion and great showing the inner world of the Chazon Ish. And it's interesting to compare that to the Lubavitch Rebbe, who also corresponded about Chaim Grada, saying, writing to Chaim Grada, why do you spend your time writing about novels and about the breakdown of religion? Why don't you write novels bringing people to Torah and mitzvahs, bringing them to belief in God? So you get a very different sort of it. Now, the Rav was a Magid Shir who got up and appreciated a Chaim Grada novel for showing the complexity of human experience.
Did his students get into Yiddish like that?
No. I mean, the Rav has a lot of praises for Yiddish and Yiddish literature along the way. But that also didn't carry over, creating the ambiguity.
I heard from a few different places of the whole part that the whole story was carried on in Yiddish in Europe, and Yiddish has a whole as long as the Jews.
Yeah,
I've heard this. You know,
yeah, it's translated in here. But it doesn't mean that the Talmidim actually made it a part of, or was part of YU or modern Orthodoxy or centrism. I mean, I say the word. You know, the Rav used to call people affairs, and the class looks at me, not knowing what the word means. So it certainly hasn't, that the Yiddish element is not carried over. Okay. The essay here on the draft, and the last thing I'm going to mention from this book, was he was asked about the Korean War draft. He gave it, and it remained hidden in the RCA files for the decades.
It was cited in the tradition article.
Okay, we knew of its existence and that people could get access to it. Okay, so it was cafeteria conversation, but but it was a very long tshuva. You see the Rav really being the Rav, even though it was about the draft. He opens up dealing with epistemology, dealing about conceptions and abstractions. He then, the body of it deals with four types of onus. The Rav liked that sort of systemization. Four types of onus, four types of lishma, giving you these abstract formulations. And then the essay ends with a lonely man of faith, solitude, and loneliness of the human condition. So it opens up with a halachic man. Epistemology, it then shows the Rav as an abstract halachicist, and then closes with a lonely man of faith ending. Also, this Korean War draft had a certain effect, which became later in the letters, because Orthodox rabbis served as chaplains in the Korean War, it then led to the bringing back an ecumenical sense that we're now going to have interfaith services and interfaith chapels among many of those who did serve, and that then became an issue at the end of the 50s, because I mean, even though the Rav was encouraging people in the end and saying, yes, you've got to be full Americans and become chaplains, the effect is that people who then served as chaplains came back as different individuals. Yes?
Is it beyond the scope of this discussion, or
yes, it's completely beyond, because it's just a whole separate discussion going through this. To continue about the shiurim. The shiurim were grand, complex shiurim that had halacha and agadata and storytelling. So figures like Pinchas Peli only edited out the machshava. Figures like a lot of the Rosh Yeshiva, only did the halacha, and someone like Rav Rakefet only did the stories. But know that the original shiurim were complex and included all of them. And they were grand shiurim beyond anything that, you know, they were just innovative. And if you want a sense of what the shiurim were actually like, in lieu of actually having sets of the Masorah notes, is the Arnold List, how do we pronounce it in America? I'm so used to it with the French one. The Listegerber one.
what's the book called?
Drushot Rav. It gives you a sense of what the Drushot were like. Also, it footnotes it to show you, because he's honest enough to say this part of the shir is in Yemezi Karo, and this part of the shir is in Shir Mazecher Avi Mori, this part of the shir was done here, and you see that one single shir was edited as all halacha by one set of editors, was edited as all machshava by another one, as all stories by another one, and that's also what makes it interesting, because these footnotes show it to all the variant versions out there of the same, and he's just working from the tapes. And these shirim is really what made the Rav the Rav. So the opening, I'm just going to give you a sense of it, even though you've probably heard a lot by now. So what I'm going to do is give you a little sense of the drashot. Then we're going to talk about, back to my 10 factors of modern orthodoxy, a little bit more on giving shir, and then we're going to talk about the actual books, Halachic Man, Lonely Man of Faith, Chamesh Drashot, figure out when we're breaking for dinner. Okay, taking example, the shir on the first shir in here on brachot. He immediately opens up with an agadata saying, dealing with an agadata saying that one should be careful to fulfill nezikin. Another person says one should fulfill pirkei avot. Another person says you should fulfill brachot. Now, the usual way of taking a midrash like that is to say it's all Yesh Omrim, or it's all Elu V'Elu. The Rav mix says that no, damages equals Pirkei Avot equals Brachot, and Brachot incorporates everything. The Rav already has a grand rubric that by the you already know by the end of the evening he's going to bring you Nezikin, Pirkei Avot, and Tfila, in halacha and agadata in a single 2.5 hour session in which you are so blown away. And that was the real quality. So he opens up dealing with what is brachot, and he talks about how bracha in Kabbalah does not mean blessing, but it means increase. And rather than even though he cites the Nefesh HaChayim, where bracha means bringing koach to Pamalia Shamala, bringing Koach to the higher realms. For the Rav, Koach means our autonomy, our creativity, how God created Torah, and now Torah is in human hands, and human free will, human autonomy, and human creativity. That's already an amazing opening, taking a statement and giving you a opening, even though it's in Halachic Man, and you guys now know it as a literary book, in those years it was known as the opening of a shir, and he then talks about how through our creativity, man, God is known in the world, and in that he's going to show how we bring God and creation in our creative acts into the world. He'll paraphrase Herman Cohen and show you how God is in the world. He then switches to tell you how everything has a male and female aspect, and that when you're a melamed, the teacher, you're male, and as a student, you're female. But then when you further become a teacher, you take on the male aspect. Once again, that is a whole history in Eastern European thought from the Maharal on. And just gets cited here as part of the package. Then moving into part of this idea of our free will and creativity is that even though we have free will and creativity, you have to understand the role of tzimtzum. There are intellectual limitations. Modern man doesn't know his limits. We've got to keep our limits. You have to have a sense of hester, a sense of knowing that God is limited and man, the world is now in the human realm, and a sense of halam, a sense of anonymity, and that you have to work as part of a bigger mesora, and that we attend, the world gets growth through education, through teaching Torah, That's just the opening, about the first third of the shiur. Now, that's a pretty much a wow if that's the first third. I mean, he would give you so many of these concepts that would repeat in the shiurim, but if in a two-hour time period, that was the first 40 minutes, that's already a great wow for a 40 minutes opening shiur. Or his shiur in here from 56. From 58, the role of the American Jew. He compares the laws of lechem to the laws of peirot. Why is, explaining halachically, why lechem is the savata and really has a halachic kiyum of the savata and benching, while peirot, it's only a din in shevach, that you've eaten the fruit, it's not a real kiyum in benching, and why the laws, therefore, Barei Nefesh are different than the laws of benching. With that sort of opening, he talks about the differences between when minimal effort is required, like fruit, versus greater effort versus in bread. And then he explains the difference between the first luchot and the second luchot. The first luchot are God to man. The second luchot are man to God, using the Beis Halevi drush number Yurchet, which he doesn't even bother, doesn't cite, because it's just a given of the building blocks. He compares Matan Torah to the idea of Chorev. He compares the idea of going into Eretz Yisrael, the first time going in versus second time. The first time is with Nisim. The second time, it's got to be Kedusha that we generate on our own. And that suffering is good. And that suffering and growth, the process of bread and Eretz Yisrael and creating our own Torah Shebaal Peh, is good. And then ties us into public versus private. Public, we think, seem easy. Private, we're all angsting and suffering. The difference between koach, which is external might, versus gevura, which is internal might. And then he ties it into current events that Jews in America tend to hide their identity. While they shouldn't, they've got to have more pride. While Israel is helping to restore pride of Americans within their Judaism. Once again, another wow drasha. If you were an audience, if you were a balabas, or even a pulpit rabbi in 1958, that gave you, if you're a pulpit rabbi, that was Chomer LeDrush for weeks and weeks of sermons. And what any of this meant was really left for you to interpret. Now let's go through my 10 points before we go to any specific texts. One, on the Bible, the Rav gave grand theological exegesis. He was influenced by the biblical writings of Martin Buber and of Karl Barth, even though he doesn't cite them. I think in the new Michael Berger edited edition, he puts in some of the footnotes, but the Rav tended not to. And equally important, the Rav took many of his drushot from the drushot of Rav Reines, Rav Nissenbaum from Warsaw, and Rav Gold. And even Rav Gold's drushot is the only book the Rav ever edited. And the Rav never footnotes when he's taking their drushot. I know of only two places where he mentioned footnotes to Rav Reines, only because somebody included it within the transcript, even though many of his drushas come from either Western or Eastern European drushot. What? What about it?
Did he follow?
He doesn't footnote Chaim Heller. Also, a lot of the Rav's exegesis comes from the Netziv, and you don't find any references to the Netziv. A real drush of the Rav should start off with Netziv and Rav Reines, Rav Gold, Buber, Karl Barth, and you don't see the references. But his approach to Bible was a theological one. Two, his relationship to the traditional yeshiva world. In this, he had his cake and he ate it too. He will talk about how the halacha and Anshei HaMasora were in complete continuity with. There is no break. There is no rupture. He is not, unlike religious Zionism, he is not seeing any break with the yeshiva world. but at the same time, he'll put Rav Reines' agenda entirely into the mouth of the Mesorah of the Halacha. He will criticize the Aguda position of the 1950s on the Holocaust and on Israel. But he will then talk about how the need to embrace the world was always the halachic position. So he has no break, but he puts all modernist statements in the continuity of halacha. So unlike modern orthodoxy, which called itself modern, or unlike religious Zionists that knew it was breaking with Eastern Europe, or Kibbutz Adati, which certainly saw a break, the Rav sees nothing but continuity, that we always must embrace the world. Now, let me get through these 10. 3, the attitude toward the laity. On one hand, he's got many statements that in America, we're very happy if the laity know nothing but basic chumash and keep basic mitzvot. But what's most important for the laity is they're following Anshei Mesorah and Anshei Halacha, unlike conservative Judaism. For the laity, he does criticize their materialism and shallowness. But on the other hand, he's got statements there where he says everything should be a halachic approach and everyone should show their love for Torah. So you will find, meaning, remember, he set up a school, Maimonides, in which Torah Shabbat Peh was one period a day. And that included tefillah and halacha, beer tefillah and halacha, meaning one period a day. And he has open statements that, you know, American Jews, chumash and basic mitzvot is what's important. But he has other statements about the all-embracingness of halacha. In terms of modern issues, his modern issue is anti-conservative movement, anti-mixed seeding, the halachic process, anti-ecumenicism. Or as he really framed it, we need basic education for Kashrut and Shabbat. What was his vision of the modern rabbi? Is someone who faces the challenges of the modern world. At other points, he'll talk about the need for abstraction, organized knowledge, or philosophy. But the one that keeps coming up all the time is to face the challenges of the modern world. Philosophy, he used neo-Kantianism and existentialism and dialectic theology. For Gentiles, on the universal level, he was opened. But he was against dialogue on religious issues. On social factors in halacha, he never wanted you. That would always get his goat. Whenever you would say, if anyone would ask any question, but times have changed, or hasn't sociology changed, that would always get him to react, and he would say the halacha is eternal, and we have to show the halachas for all times and all places. Education, he founded the Maimonides School, which clearly was co-ed, Gemara one period a day, an intellectualist with a full secular curriculum. And he did debate whether it should be religious Zionist or not, whether it should include be Hebrew and Hebrew. In the end, he decided against it, but it was very strong in Chumash and Navi. His own teachers that he imported for the school, Rabbi Simon and Rabbi Wolgemuth, were both trained in Hildesheimer, at the Berlin Seminary. So once again, showing you his tolerance between what he actually felt and the way he ran things. And in terms of academics, some of his best students, he told to do PhDs, and the PhDs were in philosophy or math or something that would lead to abstraction. Okay, and for Revel itself, he was in favor of there being a general Revel master's required as part of Smicha.
Teaching Talmud
at Revel? Talmud and philosophy were the two subjects. The Revel room used to be right next to the Shir room. There used to be a little seminar room next to Shir, and the answer was yes, because you should know about it.
So why?
But now that's not the way.
Biblical criticism.
No, it more of the parshanut and others, and more of the meaning. The Bible professor was Professor Bernstein's Professor Michal Bernstein, who taught courses more like Rav Chaim Heller's courses in Targumim, course in ancient versions, courses in Masora, not the other stuff. What?
But he would
leave it to his Rav Michal Bernstein to teach it. Yes.
Also, when we said he is a break with the yeshiva world, but not a break with the yeshiva world, is that discontinuity within continuity? Is that dissimulation or is that cognitive dissonance?
I don't know what that's part of the differences between the Talmud and what you think is going on. The fact that he basically put all of Rav Reines' agenda into Rav Chaim's mouth, I don't know how you want to label that, but that's...
I mean, it could just be like he grew up like that, like there was a fluidity and the identities never were that solid in Europe and the people in Warsaw overlapped the people in Volozhin and he just didn't see it as an issue.
I don't have a good answer for that one.
Okay.
I mean, he would say we're in direct part of the entire Balei Mesorah. All the Balei Mesorah agree with us. The halachic world is in complete agreement with us, except for those bad Naturei Karta that don't see the true meaning of right now.
But they're superstitious anyway.
But the point is, he is always in this rhetoric that it was hard to pin down. We'll do a little bit more before we break for dinner. And I'm going to do this a little quickly, a little bit about Shir, his Derech HaLimud, even though we've been doing his Machshava. And what I'm reading from is I'm trying to find somewhat of a neutral point by which to do this. Someone interviewed Rav Parnas back in the early 1980s about Derech HaLimud of the Rav. And it's dealing with about the difference between the Rav and Reb Chaim. And for those who don't, I mean, this is why you're so far from brisk right now. Originally, Reb Chaim was very clean. You created you had a problem in a Rambam. You created a chiluk to answer it. The chiluk had to be clean, is what they would say, vushtet, meaning you would hyper-read the words with a certain hyper-literalism, in which whatever wasn't in the text of the Rambam didn't exist. It was only what was right there, and then you would create a nafka mina or show how it solved problems in your reading. So it really cut through many things. The Rav, in contrast to Reb Chaim, and in contrast to Revelvel, the Rav gave an on-the-block shear and would try to answer everything up. The Rav wasn't worried about whether something was muchrach, whether something really had a nafkamina. The Rav created grand structures for everything. For example, if you see the Kuntres Ashtaros edited by Rav Schechter, you'll see it's a grand Kuntres Ashtaros that doesn't mean that every chiddush within that really is answered up some difficulty. The Rav liked creating these grand schemes in which everything, internally consistent. The Rav would include a great deal of this drush and bigger world views in this internal consistency, meaning the Rav is less chiluk and much more creating internal consistency. What else that I want to bring out here? Now since Briskers were against the Telzers who brought in Maimonidean philosophy into learning, meaning because the Telzer was to always ask the Siba, where Brisk would ask Machayev, what's the Kiyum, and the Machayev tells you would ask the Siba, the reasoning. So to in Ragachov, you could ask the Siba. So where Reb Chaim rejected questions of Siba, causality, the Rav would bring in the idea of a Kiyum. And that he would walk through that Kiyum, whether Rav Reines or the Rambam or Karl Barth or Emil Brunner or Buber or Herman Cohen, the Kiyum would be this grand state. So rather than explaining causality, the Rav would give a Machshevet Chazal of explaining the grand Kiyum of the Halacha rather than its causality. He would ask what or how, so he would ask how it works rather than why it works. Okay, I'm not sure I'm going to go into the rest of this just because it's not needed for our purposes. Okay, should I go on for another half hour? Should we break for dinner now? Or what? Any thoughts? About 15 minutes, should I go on?
Yeah.
So we'll go 15 more minutes and then we'll break for dinner. Okay, let's start with Halachic Man, the essay that I'm just going to bring. I'm going to go briefly, like I said, and my goal is not to do philosophy as much as what this is needed for orthodoxy. First of all, most people and most rabbis knew Halachic Man through Larry Kaplan's article in Tradition, in which he portrays the Rav as a neo-Kantian creative individual, and that there's an oscillation, creative individual. They knew Lonely Man of Faith, that there's an oscillation between our worldly, dignified side and our inner side of solitude. And they knew he was pro the State of Israel. There is a unpublished Masters by Bob Goldie that was done at Hebrew U that talks about the nature of the writings in general. And a lot of this is known orally, but he really collects it together. The Rav did all of his philosophic writings for himself. They really were not public statements. They were not his major time. His major time was really Kuntres Hashkaros. It really wasn't the philosophy. He was writing for himself. There is a difference between the text of the Rav and his footnotes. A lot of times the Rav's footnotes started whole separate articles. Bob Goldie also points out that a lot of times the Rav would ask a question from general philosophy or a universal question, and then proceed to answer it in halachic terms. And a lot of people misread. They either thought he was asking a halachic question, which was never there in the text, and eisegetically reading it into the text, and therefore blaming him for it. Or they thought he was giving a secular philosophic answer. Or those who thought he was asking secular philosophy, blaming him that he wasn't giving a secular answer. Is he would ask a secular question and then answer it in halachic terms. Big part of the way he worked. You know what, if I'm going to do anything before breaking, I think I would rather do Chamesh Drashot. Let's get started with that. The new Chamesh Drashot, Halachic Man and Lonely Man of Faith, a little bit quickly, just to, where does it fit into modern orthodoxy? Okay. Chamesh Drashot, which is now called the Rav Speaks. Every pulpit rabbi knew sections 3-3 and 3-4. 3-3 and 3-4 is where he says that an Orthodox Jew must have modern thought and modern categories, and that a scientist can speak the same language as the Vilna Gaon, and you can study both Vilna Gaon and science. Section 3, okay, and that's in 3.3. But in, elsewhere, other parts of Halachic Man, Chamesh Drashot, he'll talk about how the entire state of Israel should be in the hands of the guardians of the Masorah. What does that mean? We're not really sure, because elsewhere he said that we have to trust the generals. I mean, he didn't have a worked out position.
That where the Shachar said no.
That was.
That the decision should only be made by those people who do the unique harm.
I don't know. I think that they'll broad men many wages, because once again, when he was asked in 67, 68, every general was not a believer in the Ikarim. So, meaning...
You just want to be left alone by the general.
I'm not going to speculate on what it is. I'm going to say what he said. You guys can create your own left and right positions from it. In section 3.2, he says that he applauds the state of Israel for its heroism, but on the other hand, he says our true gevura is not the fighting army, but it's keeping Hilchos Nida.
So, that?
Yeah, because that's his classic example in several, in both in the letters, in the drushas, in the article on suffering. He likes that as an example.
Responding to
the human needs, and therefore we have to have that Koach HaTzimtzum. So once again, that's why someone like Avi Ravitsky says he won't deal with the Rav on Zionism, because there's no real acknowledgement of the state. If you can say we believe in the Gevura, but our true Gevura is Hilchos Nida, you're not really dealing with an Israeli perspective. In section 4.3, the Rav tells you that the Judaism of Abraham shows the singularity of the Jewish people, that Jews are singular, meaning they're outside of ordinary history and ordinary life. And the phrase singularity is from dialectic theology of Barth and Brunner, meaning outside of culture, that Abraham is a unique individual and Jewish people are unique, and therefore all Jews have to care about all Klal Yisrael. And he later developed that in Kol Dodi Dofek, about we all have one common fate. All Jews are part of one faith community, whether they're religious or not, even if they're not part of they're not lead a redeemed existence. In 4.2, he will quote Rav Nachman of Breslov, the only place he does this in his writings, to say wherever you have Talmidei Chachamim, you have a din of Eretz Yisrael. Once again, creating ever more ambiguities.
Was that when he was on a boat?
Yeah. But once again, it's this. And in 5.4, the Rav says Torah's lo b'shamayim hi. We shouldn't be isolationists. We can't be separate. We have to go out and embrace the world. And in 5.5, he says we have to deal with economics, politics, and the real world. But at the same time, he had just said in the sections before that how moving to Israel is entirely just about a mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz and living in Eretz Yisrael. So once again, back to the contradictions. If it's entirely living in Eretz Yisrael, he'll quote the anti-Zionist, the Avnei Nezer, to say there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, and then say, but at the same time, we have to deal with politics, economics, and the real world. Once again, why did he hold both ends of the dilemma, and how could he resolve them in his own mind, remains a question. Back to the bigger structure of the book, and we'll deal with it as five separate lectures. In the first lecture, he doesn't mention by name, but he really takes Rav Reines' drasha, or Chadash al Tzion, that we all have to be Joseph the dreamer and have a vision for Zionism. So already he's taking Rav Reines' drasha, and religious Zionism, and the fact that we need to have a vision, and so we have to be dreamers and a God. It's a and then he ends up by saying that if we follow Rav Reines, we're in a continuity with Rav Chaim. Lecture 2, because Rav Chaim studied Zeroyim, and he learned much Hilchos Tzuliyah, many mitzvot Tzuliyah Ba'aretz. Lecture 2, Lecture 2, modern man is in crisis. He's got to know the meaning of his soul. Mizrahi has the answers. 3, we have to be thankful for Mizrahi because it strengthens Torah. He says, don't listen to the people that think that Mizrahiites think that you should work the land, or that Mizrahiites like Kibbutz Adati study in the German method of more scholarship than Eastern European Torah. Don't listen to those who think that religious Zionism is about more about politics. No, it's about a direct continuity of Talmud Torah. And he ends off that essay criticizing why did Israel take money for Germany. That's how he ties in other, not in the edited version, in some of the other versions. Lecture 4.
He brings up the mythos of Holocaust Mindset.
Yes and no, because in the end he does an issue. He talks about it in the abstract once again.
Right.
Lecture 4. Eretz Yisrael is about a mitzvah. And he says that the Mizrahi movement in Israel, Kibbutz Adati and Mamlakti Adati, have the exact same mission statement as REITs. Once again, I don't know what to make of that statement, that REITs and the Mizrahi movement have the exact same agenda, and that the true mission of Mizrahi is KBY. But that seeing is once again education and Torah. Finally, in the fifth lecture, he talks about the need to have an intuition and to see its importance and its miraculousness, and that we have to be involved in the modern world. Okay, so that's the sort of tone we find in everything of this, and what you want to call it.
Did the Rav have
a sense? Did the Rav have...
Besides the Rambam.
Did the Rav... No, the answer is... It's,
I mean,
certainly, since the point being in America now, he was really someone who sat there working things through.
And I know that you don't want to psychoanalyze, but is there anything within other, psychological studies or anything that, like, a person who studies by himself can conceptualize things greater than what has to go against somebody else? Or is there a difference? I mean,
there are studies that don't talk about different styles of learning. And there are Sifrei Machshava that talk about different styles of learning. Okay, but he clearly sat there and worked things through on his own. Okay. Talk a little bit about the Lonely Man of Faith, and then I'll break, because I think it's important to get some of that in. Let me find... Let me put on my towel in the middle of this. What?
Do we have to
use the name?
I think you can probably catch somebody outside walking to Mincha here.
What?
Here in Onatefka, you can really walk out of the shuttle, and you will be able to catch people on the way. Actually, you can actually look out my front window and point to, this one went to YU in my year, this one's 2 years above me, this one's 3 years behind me. You can go down the street here and point everyone out. On the other hand, my direct neighbor across the street is Benny King, from the Drifters, from the song Under the Boardwalk. So, yes.
I was trying to guess on shots of
Michelin stars. Easy Jewish.
What? Okay, let me finish. If not, we're just losing it. We should break here. You think we should just break here and we're losing it at this point?
I could go for more.
No, you just got it. What's the... You know what, so let's...
Fine, I'll pay more.
Okay, so let's break here and have dinner, because I already hear everyone's getting a little antsy. We're gonna, it's a good... Good opening. So just to let it to end, that this should make it onto the tape, is we are going to do Halachic Man, Lonely Man of Faith, and a little bit of some of the other writings next time, but not as philosophy, but where it fits into Orthodoxy. And then we'll get start in Chabad and finish Chabad next time. And if there's any time left over, I'll deal with someone who's rather Yotzei Dofen, which is Rav Amital.